to do the preliminaries before we have the meeting, I will explain that this is the 10th annual congressional luncheon, and every year up until now, the chaplain of the House of Representatives has been here to do the invocation. His niece is getting married sometime today in Minnesota, and he can't be here. I think he tried to get them to change the wedding plan. But they wouldn't, and but we have one of the most able fill-ins to do the invocation that AA can offer, and I'm going to call on Kevin Jay for that. Kevin?
You finally let me make the big time. My name is Kevin Johnson, a very grateful alcoholic.
Amen.
Let us be grateful. Dear Lord, we thank you for the blessings and the many gifts you bestow upon us on a daily basis. At the top of our gratitude list, we put our thanks for your gift of sobriety. You bestowed upon us the miracle that relieved us of the terror, bewilderment, frustration, and loneliness that surrounded us in the depths of our alcoholic despair. We are grateful and we thank you. And please bless the memory of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, who through your grace showed us a way, spiritual in its nature, but human in its effort to stay sober one day at a time. The simple process of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, as we are doing here today. And we ask you to bless this food which we are about to receive, and may we be grateful and remember when we were physically unable to eat or wouldn't use our money to buy food. Again, dear Lord, we thank you for all these blessings. Amen.
That's the first time I've ever heard an invocation get applause. Kevin, you have indeed reached the big time. Lunch is served. We will be back at 12:45 to start the program. Welcome to the 10th Annual Congressional Luncheon. My name is Ed Chandler, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'm glad to be here. And we have the usual, typical, just like it's been nine times in a row program, except we have a different speaker today. I'll tell you, as each year I usually do, the one-minute history of this luncheon is that Dr. Gratitude, Dr. Marley, one day discovered that they have small dining rooms in the Capitol, and Dr. Marley had never had lunch in one of those dining rooms. And so he assigned me the task of taking care of that for him, you know, get a luncheon together. And I did. I got a room and got a menu and started asking people by word of mouth if they'd like to come to lunch with Dr. Gratitude. And the room held 45 people. And pretty quick I had 46 people. And then pretty quick I had 50. And so I had to get a different room. And I got this room. And with that many people, I said, God, you got to have a speaker if you're going to have that many people. And so I got Ernie the attorney, who is here today. Ernie, where are you?
Hey, Ernie.
Ernie the attorney. Ernie was the first, the speaker at the first congressional luncheon, and lo and behold, I had 179 people at lunch. And it was, everyone seemed to have a good enough time. I said, well, we'll just do this every year, and so it's now grown into this where there's people who send their money in and I have to send it back because there's not room to get in. So I'm glad that you all are here today. A couple of people that I want to recognize in the audience. Dick Patch, who is the current delegate to GSO in New York, right here, the D.C. delegate. Dick? The U.S. House of Representatives now has an EAP program. It is, by my count, I figured this very closely and used, you know, all imagination I had to do the computation. I think they're 32 years too late. But the House of Representatives now has an EAP program, and I'm delighted. And the director of the program is here, Byrne Beidl. But and, of course, with him, all that everyone knows is Nick Gottschall, Nick, the administrative assistant in the program. The clerk of the House is was due. If he comes in, then I will recognize him. I will now call on Karen B. to come and read how it works. Karen?
My name is Karen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thank you, Karen. Very quickly, the other thing that's kind of evolved at the luncheon that's I'm real grateful about is there are some people here today who are not members of AA. AA members have begun to bring family members and bosses and some employees to this to kind of introduce them to AA. And I think some of them maybe need to be introduced to AA. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. But I'm really glad about that. And if you're a guest here, I really especially welcome you, and I hope you enjoy the program. The other one quick announcement is Earl does the taping. He will have tapes of this meeting available as soon as it's over. He also has with him several copies of tapes from each of the last 9 congressional luncheons if you want to pick those up. I think that's all the preliminaries I have, and in order to get the meeting going and to introduce the speaker, I now call on Hal Hemm.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Hal Marley. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Well, thank Kevin for that very nice invocation. Where'd you get all that gratitude talk, Kevin? I am indeed a grateful alcoholic because I have a long gratitude list. I'm extremely grateful this afternoon for the privilege and pleasure of introducing our speaker. For us older members of the fellowship, Mary is not new. She spoke here at the Washington Intergroup Banquet some 20 years ago. Back in the good old days where we had it at the then the Wardman Park, now the Washington Sheraton, 1,500 people, black tie, a real festive occasion. So, Mary, it's wonderful to have you back. Mary has not only spoken here, she's spoken all over the country, Canada, various A activities for a long, long time. I had a recent example of the smallness of the alcoholic program, the small world of AA, we call it. 2 weeks ago, I was down at an A convention in Mount Eagle, Tennessee, small convention of 100 people. And after the Friday night meeting, we're sitting around in the coffee room, chit-chatting, and one of my southern friends had been to the Yays and Nays group when he comes to Washington on business, and he'd heard about this lunch. Isn't it about time of the year for the A luncheon, the Yays and Nays lunch at the Capitol? I said, yes, as a matter of fact, it's the 24th of this month. And our speaker is Mary Regan from Clancy's group in L.A. George M., another old A friend, the next day said, Mary Regan? I know her. I used to get drunk with her in China during World War II. Well, I'd known George. He's a good A member. You know, A members stop lying when they join A and get honest. So I did not question George's statement. However, I hope that Mary will include in her remarks a little light on the statement that George made down at the house. So please join me in giving Mary a big Washington welcome. Mary?
Thank you, Hal. My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to express my gratitude for the warm welcome I've received here, especially when I walked into the room and saw a lot of people that I've known, that I've met on the road of happy destiny. Sandy over here is an old friend of mine from many years ago. We used to chase around crazy together. And I want to thank Frank also for picking me up at the airport and taking me to the White House. I feel very special, I'll tell you. But I'm not here to tell you about all these things. I'm here to talk about my drinking. And I can wrap up my whole drinking career by quoting what the cat said when he got through making love to the skunk. He said, I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand. There must be some recognition here. Anyway, I'll start off by saying that I knew when I was a child that I was going to be the greatest dancer in the world, and I was given ballet lessons and dancing and tap and acrobatic and all this. I lived in that dream world. And the day after I graduated from high school in Salt Lake City, at the age of 16, I joined what was then known as the roadshow or the end of vaudeville. And when we were traveling around, we traveled in caravans, in the cars. And while we were traveling one time, somebody brought out a bottle of slow gin. And I know that some of the young people don't even know what that is, but for some of you old people that know the quality of things, I realize that, you know, in talking that way, I'm dating myself. And as a matter of fact, I've been giving some thought to having a facelift because that's pretty popular in Southern California, you know. But then, you know, on sober reflection, why get a facelift when everything else is sagging? You know? I tell you, it's a sad day when you're trying on one of those cross your knees bras. But I'm here to talk about my drinking. I keep it. And what I want to say about that first swig of slow gin is that I drank, you know, I drank all that I could, threw up and passed out, and that was my pattern. I just set the pattern right there. I finally wound up in the nightclubs of San Francisco as a featured dancer. And there, you know, featured dancers in San Francisco, I had it all made. I had all that stuff that's supposed to make you happy. You know, I had the furs and the jewelry and the write-up. Herb Cain used to call me the Belle of Bush Street. And, you know, I table hopped every night giving everybody a break, you understand. And I walked around wondering why I wasn't happy. I seemed unfulfilled. And then I realized that the reason I was unfulfilled was because Hollywood hadn't discovered me yet. And came the day when Hollywood discovered me, and I was invited down to take a screen test. And I went down there with an attitude that you might be familiar with, that Betty Davis had better start saving her money because I was on my way down. And I went down, and I took the screen test, and it was rotten. Well, how can you act when you're already acting? But I didn't know that. However, they did sign me to a stock contract, which means that you're out on a lot and, you know, with the rest of the herd. And I did some dancing and I did some bit parts and I hobnobbed with the hoi polloi. But most of all, the strange thing, I was attracted to the people who drank. Isn't that strange? I seemed to have a built-in radar and I made all these fancy nightclubs and supper clubs, Sunset Boulevard, all those places, Ciro's, Mocambo, those places that you read about in the movie magazines. And I was a party girl is what I was. And toward the end of the second year on that lot, I just kind of felt that my career was really not going anywhere because I didn't do anything memorable yet. But about that time, a man from the USO office offered me an opportunity to go overseas and entertain the soldiers. And the first thing I thought of was all those men over there. That's why I love this luncheon this morning. You know, there's a lot of you out there. And it will come as no surprise to you that I got into a lot of trouble over there because, see, I was one of those who could not accurately predict my conduct once I took a drink. Now, this trip took us to China, Burma, and India, and you're right. And you know, we were in the Himalaya Mountains someplace, and I came to one morning. And now, I want to say this, though. There must be some in here who were in that World War and still keep a resentment against USO girls that fraternized only with the officers. I'm here to remove your resentment. I drank with Yardbirds, General, to make any difference to me. I just said, where, and let's go. So anyway, this the incident I was talking about came to in the Himalaya Mountains someplace, and I was paralyzed. This was before I was alcoholic. I was absolutely paralyzed, and they got the medics in there, and they gave me shots and oxygen, and they walked me back and forth for about an hour, I don't know how long, just to get me on my feet and functioning again. You know, I blamed the altitude. I didn't even drink in Denver after that. I knew that I couldn't drink in altitude. But you have to defend your right to drink. But anyway, I came back from that tour. I felt very, and Hal, you're right, that guy, what he did, get drunk with me. In fact, I spoke down there, and his wife followed us around like a hawk, you know. I don't blame her. He's cute. I came back from that tour, and I felt very put upon because the military had forgotten or neglected to tell us that they expected us to entertain between shows. And I thought that was, you know, that wasn't right. That isn't the way I looked at it. But anyway, I came back and I thought to myself, you know, I'm always making, today I can live in a manner that's acceptable to me regardless of public opinion because, you know, I could not, I was a people pleaser and I could not do anything without your approval, without your thinking I was great or whatever it was. And, you know, today I don't have to make those nickel and dime compromises and I don't have to sell a piece of my soul out by doing what I think you want me to do or saying what I think you want me to say. Today I'm free of that. And so when I got back, I was now offered the opportunity to go overseas to the European Theater, and I said to myself at that time, this time it's going to be different. This time everything's not going to go by me in a big gray haze, and this time I'm not going to drink so much, and I'm not going to attend all those drunken parties, and I'm going to be, this time, well, you people have read my story in the big book. It's entitled Chapter 3. This time it was different. And you're looking at maybe the only USO girl that was up for court-martial. I have to explain that. Like I said, I could never accurately predict my conduct, but I was always madly in love, either that or recovering from love, and I don't know which I enjoyed the most, you know. When you're recovering from love, you get the jug out and you get that sad music on, you know. And you play the music and you drink and you cry. God, I see the guys are nodding over there. Yeah, yeah. My favorite was The Man Who Got Away. That one, or Is That All There Is? But you never play anything that has any hope to it, you know. Always get that sad music on. So anyway, I fell in love with this handsome lieutenant over in Germany. And I found myself several towns away from where we first met, again, in a big drinking party, and I suddenly decided, you know how you do, you suddenly decide, that I needed to get in touch with the great love of my life, so I got on a field telephone, which meant we had to go through relays. It takes a while to make the connection. And while I was waiting for this voice, a captain who was also drinking came over and asked me to go drink or play or whatever. And I very dramatically, I was always dramatic, told him that I was waiting for the voice of the great love of my life. And he took his thumb and disconnected the phone. And I said to him, Captain, if you do that once more, I'm going to hit you. And he didn't believe me because he did it again. And since I had the phone right here in my hand, I whacked him on the ear. And I think I hit him a little harder than I intended. But, in fact, he did not know what happened for a couple of minutes there until he saw the blood gush out of his ear and down his white trench coat. And, God, when he saw that, he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hostile and signed all these papers. And they came trooping over, and he pointed me out. And, God, you know, that's humiliating. That's embarrassing. But he pointed me out, and I was ordered to appear the next morning at 10 o'clock for this hearing. And, of course, I spent the rest of the night trying to figure out how I was going to get out of this one. Did you ever do that? The best thing I could come up with was, since there were 14 girls on this show, that if I took two girls with me that most resembled me, there was an outside chance that this guy was so loaded he wouldn't be able to identify me. And so we showed up at 10 o'clock as ordered. And that poor captain was sitting there. He had one of those hangovers that were coming over in waves. You know, you could feel them across the room. And he looked back and forth and back and forth, and that poor guy couldn't identify me. And I like to tell that story every time I talk because in my heart, I hope, in looking back, he was one of us, I'm sure. In my heart, I hope he found the fellowship. And in my heart, I hope that someday I'll be talking from the podium and tell this story, and he'll be in the audience. And after the meeting, he'll come up to me with his hand extended and say, Mary, I'm the captain you hit on the ear in Germany. And I'm going to let him make his amends to me.
Well,
Now, we weren't always wrong, you know. Even a clock that stopped is right twice a day. I don't know when this happened any more than you did, but it seems to me that it happened long before I realized it, that I got into a terrible, terrible depression because now the booze was not working. And I became restless, irritable, and discontented, like the doctor's opinion says. And I tried to drink it back, and I tried to manufacture it, and I tried everything I could, and to no avail. And, of course, I blamed man's inhumanity to man on the destruction I had seen and the terrible sights I'd seen. And I just knew that the world was never going to be the same again. And I got really, really depressed. And I said to myself, the only place I ever had any fun was in the San Francisco nightclubs. I mean, how much fun can you endure, for God's sake? So when I got back, I headed right for San Francisco, and everything there seemed to have changed. Even my drinking buddies, they all seemed different to me. It was just all in my head, I'm sure. And I felt desolate, and I felt, you know, like I didn't know which way to turn, which way to go, and nothing was pleasing me. And no one could. And I finally decided that since I'd been all over the world and done everything, the thing for me to do is to get married and settle down. So I selected a victim, and it happened to be a bartender I couldn't stand. Now, I've neglected to tell you that I didn't hang around people that didn't drink. And this guy did not drink. But any Al-Anon in this room will tell you that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it. Because he turned out to be a compulsive gambler. You know what kind of a marriage it was? He gambled my drinking money, and I drank his gambling money. But I was at a stage in my life where I just really could not stand another failure because, see, I had never achieved my goal, never had. I had come very close but never achieved my goal. And so I decided that I was going to salvage this come hell or high water. And in order to do that, I had to move to Southern California, get him away from those bookies. So we moved down to suburbia in the San Fernando Valley, and I met a drinking buddy right across the street from me, and he met a bookie up on the corner, and the race was on again. And so I decided the thing for me to do, really, is to get pregnant, have a baby, and that would just glue the whole thing together. So I got pregnant, and now my whole image changed. In that I was going to do everything by the numbers. I was going to be a perfect mother, housewife, woman. I was going to be the whole thing. I was going to be perfect. And I also knew that what I was going to do was join the PTA, be a Cub Scout mother. I was going to wear pink curlers to the market. And I was going to do all those things that those neighbors of mine were doing. And I knew that this woman that I was now going to be did not drink. So I went on the wagon. God, I can't use that expression here. Choked me up. Anyway, I became a compulsive housekeeper. There's always one or two in the audience, but I used to clean the corners with pins. And I had a pocket full of Q-tips that I got the underside of things with. And I had a toothbrush in the other pocket that got the lettering on the appliances with. And if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the John, his bed was made before he got back. And that's a tense way to live. And this went on for quite a while until I found, you know, it's a wonder I didn't boil that kid when he was born, because I was washing the walls with Hexol, you know, just madness. This went on for a few months until I found out I was pregnant the second time. And, you know, I hadn't planned this second one. You know how it is when you don't plan something? I always drank with two attitudes. One was, what's the use? And the other is, I'll show him. And here it was, what's the use? What's the use? Doesn't everybody know how hard I tried to be perfect? Wasn't I doing everything by the numbers? What's the point in it? What's the point in it all? To hell with it. I'm going to have a drink. So I went across the street to my lady friends and had a couple of drinks. And I got away with it. Then next day I had a couple more drinks. Got away with it. The only problem with that is, you know, somebody like me having a couple of drinks and getting away with it, it's like the guy jumping out of the Empire State Building. As he passed the 30th floor, he says, so far, so good. Yeah. So So that's the way it was. And it's here that I discovered my native habitat. Once again, the neighborhood bar. God, I love the bars. I am a bar drinker, folks. I love the bar. I love the unreal atmosphere in there. You know, the tinkling piano and the tinkling ice cubes and the guys in there tell me how sexy and desirable and smart I was. God, you know, I could walk into a bar with a dollar and stay for 3 days. Yeah, and you guys that are laughing were picking up my tab. Don't forget that. But, you know, here I was, you know. It's funny now, but I look back on that, and I'm not proud of the fact that I was, you know, going up to the bar and floundering around that neighborhood while I was pregnant. I'm not proud of that, but I'm just reporting you. I'm here to tell you the truth. I'm reporting to you what happened to me on my way to AA. And so, anyway, my husband took a dim view of my actions after my second son was born, and he left me, came back, left me, came back, always with the promise that he wouldn't gamble so much if I didn't drink so much. Now, you know that we couldn't even keep our own promises to ourselves, never mind anybody else. And so, as a result of one of these joyous reunions, I got pregnant the third time. And now I was outraged womanhood. God, you know, this rage that I had against it, it just added fuel to my alcoholic fire. Of course, as I say, you know, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I had a right now. I had a right to do whatever I wanted to do. And after my third child was born, he left me for what proved to be the last time. And now I was free to do what I wanted to do, which was to return to my role as a party girl. After all, I was terribly miscast in this role as a mother and wife and all those things. I was terribly miscast. What I am is a party girl. And so all those things that happened to alcoholic women started happening to me in rapid succession. I remember coming to in an alley one cold gray dawn, sick and shaking and scared and wondering what had become of the great Belle of Bush Street. And I remember the bartender, 10 o'clock in the morning, ordering me out. And I had no recollection of having been there because I was in a long time into blackout drinking. But I hope I never forget one Sunday morning when I was lurching down Ventura Boulevard. I was dirty because I had given up bathing. It was too dangerous. I came to one morning and my nose was about an inch from the water and I knew right then that it was too dangerous for me to bathe anymore. I could have killed myself. You know, I could have drowned. And so in those days what I was doing is splashing large quantities of Taboo on me. And that mixed with 86 proof sweat, I'll tell you. But that's gracious living, I guess. But anyway, here I was on this Sunday morning, lurching down Ventura Boulevard. You know, my knees could never hold me up, and I was falling against buildings, and I was falling down, and I fell down flat on my face in front of a Catholic church where Mass was just letting out. And I hope I never forget the look in those little kids' eyes as they saw this dirty, drunken woman lying flat on the ground in front of this church. And, you know, I was choking on my own disgust and biting back my tears and wishing to God I could die on the spot. And those things kept happening to me, and there are many other things that happened to me, and I don't have to go into detail with you women who think that maybe I didn't do what you did. I probably did. Anything you've done has been done here in spades and probably by me. But, see, the point is I don't have to live that way anymore. Anyway, all those things happening drove me into drinking behind drawn curtains and closed doors. And in this homicidal fury I was in, I just drank around the clock knowing I had to kill this guy. And I really mean that I would have had I had the opportunity, because that was the madness that I got into. I was so paranoid I couldn't go outside, and I had the booze delivered, and it was just total madness. And for some reason, I was drinking one night, and for some reason, I picked up the phone and called the North Hollywood Clubhouse. That was before they had a central office out in San Fernando Valley. And a young man answered the phone, and he said he'd be right out. I guess he sensed my desperation. And, you know, he broke one of the unwritten rules of AA. In that men don't call on women. They're not supposed to. Anyway, you know, it took me 2 years on this program to remember where I'd heard about AA. And then I remembered 2 years afterwards, 2 years before this phone call, I had been in a drunken brawl across the street from my house. And there was a red-haired woman there sitting there drinking a Coke. And I hated women, especially those who didn't drink. But she said something to me about having found a better way to live and something about AA. And I probably walked away with my nose in the air. But here it was 2 years later that I was making the call, which reminds me that my responsibility is to scatter the seed and not demand that it sprout on the spot. So here I was, and this man who came out to call on me, now if he had any romantic inclinations on the way out, when I answered the door, especially if he was downwind, I often wonder if he thought, what an odor, I can't go through with it. Of course, that was quickly followed by, do not be discouraged. But I was standing there in my moo-moo, drinking vodka out of my cheese glass. And he came in with the front cover of The Grapevine. It was the Serenity Prayer. It was a March issue. And I looked at it, and I thought it was a nice little prayer. Now, you got to remember, I really didn't think I was alcoholic, but I don't remember what he said, but I kept drinking. And finally, I said, aren't you going to stop me from drinking? And he said, no, go ahead. Well, that got my attention. So he broke rule number two then. He said, you know, you're an alcoholic. And I thought, God, that sounds rather scientific compared to what they have been calling me in this neighborhood. And I immediately knew this man was brilliant, you know. So I drank some more, and finally he said, would you like to go out to a meeting? And I said, what meeting? And he said, there's a meeting out in Chatsworth. And I said, you mean there are other people that'll talk to me? And he said, yeah, there's a whole room full out there. I said, well, you know, a long distance has been hanging up on me. And he said, well, he said, just let's go. So I went in and got my raincoat on, and I, to this day, I don't know why, because it wasn't raining, but I put a raincoat on, and I got into his car, and I, just before I got into his car, I said, is it okay if I had just one more drink? He said, sure, go ahead. And I poured a drink, and I, in alcoholic fashion, I said, to hell with it. And that's the last drink I've had from that day to this. I've been allowed to stay sober since March the 29th, 1961. For that, I am you know, you shouldn't applaud anyone for length of sobriety. You know, I heard John Larroquette talking to Phil Donahue one day, and he was talking about his alcoholism. He didn't mention AA, of course, but he was talking about his alcoholism and the terrible things that had done to him and the tragedies and the this, that, and the other. And when he got through, a little lady in the audience raised her hand, and he called on her. She said, Mr. Larroquette, I want to congratulate you for not drinking. And he said, lady, congratulating an alcoholic for not drinking is like congratulating a cowboy with hemorrhoids for not riding his horse. Anyway, I got into the car, and we drove for miles and miles and miles out into the boonies, way out in the darkness. It was just terrible. And I knew that this guy was going to take me out in the hills and kill me. But I didn't even care, because I'd been a failure at suicide, too. So we got finally to this little church, and he said, I'll go park the car. And it said, in that little room back of the church, you go look in the window. So I looked in the window, and here they're about 20, 25 people in there. They're all clean, and they're laughing and hugging and kissing and rubbing up against, you know, like we do. And I just knew that I didn't belong there, because I just knew I didn't belong there. Those people weren't like me. And so I think he sensed that I was backing off. So he took me around to the front door, and he said, well, look in there. And I looked in, and he took his hand and shoved me in. Now, that's promotion. That's not attraction, folks. So he introduced me to the woman who was to become my first sponsor, and she represented everything I hated in women. She was soft-spoken, spiritual, well-groomed, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she spoon-fed my soul. She took me home that night, and she gave me some orders. One was to take a bath. Now, I wondered what they wanted. What do these people want from me, you know? It wasn't enough that I just showed up, for God's sake. That was going through my head. And she said, I will pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and we're going to a woman's meeting. I almost threw up. I couldn't tell her that I hated women. But the next day, now, I tell you, I don't remember what happened, what was said at that meeting except one sentence, but what happened in that meeting was something that I hope happens to any new people that are here today. What happened was I really felt a power so powerful, that power of love, unconditional love, that has been with me ever since. That power that has been in every meeting I've been to in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel it here today. That's the thing that I took home with me that night. And when I came to the next morning, I was as sick as I've ever been, I think. I was sweating and I was shaking, and I knew that I had to get an early start in trying to get ready because I was so sick, and I really wanted a drink out of that bottle, that half a fifth that I'd left on the sink. Every pore in my body wanted a drink, not to get drunk, but to get well. And I remembered what one man had said there at that meeting. He said, any damn fool can stay sober for 24 hours. And I didn't want him to think I was a damn fool. So I toughed it out, and I drank a lot of water that day, and I went to the woman's meeting that night, and I tell you, I really didn't belong there. See, I felt so dirty, both outside and inside. I knew that I just didn't belong there. I would never fit in there. This whole thing was just hopeless. It was just absolutely hopeless. But I think when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, because the next gal that got up and started to talked in my native tongue, which was profanity. And I got a sudden surge of hope again, you know. And I made a beeline for her, you can believe that. But anyway, I started going to 10 meetings a week. Not that I could understand anything that was said, but I wanted all of that feeling that I was getting that night. I wanted all of it. And I kept going to the meetings, and I was lucky enough to be in a group out at Chatsworth where they had a nucleus of 5 hard-nosed old-timers. And I have to tell you, I have the utmost respect for old-timers that cared more for my survival than they did my approval and wouldn't let me get away with anything. And so it was that I was really happily, merrily going along when my husband, who found out I was an AA, started calling me and threatening to take the children and threatening to kill me in his own madness. And it was driving me crazy, and I couldn't tell my sponsor because I was afraid she would leave me. I don't know what I was afraid of, but I couldn't tell her. And finally, I was hanging by my fingernails, really, trying to hang on to not drinking, when I suddenly decided I'd better tell her. So I called her up, and I was just hysterical. I said, he just called me. He's going to kill me. He's going to take my children. And I went babbling on. And I said, what am I going to do? And she said, well, why don't you hang up? It never occurred to me to hang up. I come from where you get even. But, they were telling me all kinds of crazy things to do that I had no idea of. But anyway, I did it. Next time he called, I just answered the phone. I said, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting my serenity, and hung up real fast. And so I kept doing that, and then I was ordered to make amends to him about a month later, and I said, I don't want to do that, and they said, yes, but that's what we do here. And I said, well, I don't want to do that. I didn't do it until much later, but again, about a month later, he called me and again threatened me, and that was the night of the woman's meeting. I went screaming to that stag, and I was just hysterical. I just thought I was going to come apart. And I said, what am I going to do with this guy? And you know, the very elegant lady that was leading the meeting that night, she said, pray for the son of a bitch. Now, I understood that. And I said, I don't want to. And, of course, you know, everything I've ever, my whole sobriety consists of things I don't want to do. And so that night, I started praying for him, and I didn't mean a damn word of it, I'll tell you. I didn't mean a word of it, but I kept doing it because they told me to. And, you know, kept praying for him, and it didn't change him one bit, but I'll tell you what, I was privileged to make my amends to this man before he, 2 days before he died of a heart attack. And I don't know what I would have done had he died when I hated him so much. Instead of that, I was given this gift. And I was given the words to tell my children, because I had three little children, and it was difficult. It was difficult mostly, I think, because we had been running a restaurant for about 12 years, and we were very deeply in debt to the IRS because of his gambling. And I thought I was off the hook, but you know, those old-timers said no, that I had to make financial amends because I was part of the deal. And I thought that was very unfair, but I had no choice. So I started running the restaurant by myself, and I started my poverty period here. We lived on my late husband's Social Security and a very small insurance payment. And I took all the rest of the money and paid the IRS and all the other everybody else that we owed, which was in 1961, $16,000 was a lot of money. But anyway, we got into that, and I was running the restaurant, and the AA people were coming in buying the sandwiches and the food and the coffee and so forth and so on, and pretty soon we started a meeting there. And it wasn't long after that we had two meetings going there. Before the end of the year, we had all the old-timers coming out from North Hollywood saying that we needed a clubhouse at that end of the area, at that end of the valley. So I got permission at the end of the year, when all the bills were paid, to turn it into a clubhouse. And so we started the clubhouse, and it's still in existence, by the way. It's called The Nest. Maybe some of you have heard of it. It's the sickest damn club in the world. But it's still, a lot of sobriety came out of it. The reason it's so sick is because we accepted all the rejects from the other clubs. But there was a lot of sobriety that came out of it. At that time, I saw him across the crowded room. You know him? I know that doesn't happen around here. But I saw him, and our eyes locked, you know, and we fell madly, passionately in love, and we would have gotten married, except he already was. That doesn't happen here, does it? But anyway, I was behind the coffee bar there for about a year, and I finally got a job in a hospital kitchen. I took the job, and I was going to be a diet aide, but as it turned out, the dishwasher in the small hospital in Encino would show up a lot of times drinking or drunk. And you can guess who got to wash pots and pans and clean employees' toilets. Me. I hated that job. In the meantime, my first sponsor her husband had been transferred to San Francisco, and I was following a little guy around listening to him, and I thought he was the most brilliant man I ever heard in my life, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and you all know him, and he told me to say hello to all of you. His name's Clancy. He's my hero. And we're not supposed to have heroes in AA, but he's my hero. I mean, how many people do you know that sponsor four people that have 30 years sobriety? I don't think there are very many. But that guy is a dynamite, you know, and I owe him everything I have today. He's a fascist, and he's a dictator, and he's mean, and thank God. Because if he had handed me with kid gloves, you'd have a different speaker today, I can guarantee you. But he knew exactly how to handle me. And I used to complain to him about this job in the hospital. I used to moan to him a lot. And he'd say, "You got another job to go to, kid?" And I'd say, "No." And he said, "Well, when God's ready to move you, he'll move you." And I thought, oh, God, what an answer. What an answer. And I just kept plugging along. And, you know, the day came when I realized why God had put me in that menial job. Me, the big movie star and the UFO star and the, you know, sex, what did he call me? Sex symbol of the 60s or something. Anyway, I found out one morning when my son, who had made first string varsity in high school, asked me to go to his football game, and it suddenly struck me like a ton of bricks. See, my values were always money, property, and prestige. As I told you, I had all that stuff, and I always came up empty, but here it was. I had never, ever in my life experienced gratitude. And when he asked me to go to his football game, it was such a thing. I can't even describe the gratitude that surged up into my neck. And I thought, this is why God put me here, to change my values, to show me the spiritual values that they're talking about in AA. And so it was that I walked into that football stadium, and I was listening to the voices that made it possible for me to be walking in there sober with my head up, because you see, it could have been very different. If I showed up at all, I could have been a disgrace and an embarrassment to my kid. Instead of that, I had this privilege of walking in there in one of the most important days of his life. And I sat clear in the end zone, and I watched those kids warming up out on the field, and I said to myself, my God, I could have missed it all. I could have missed it all if it wasn't for those people. And when they called his name out as a starting player, I broke down and cried, because I couldn't contain the gratitude that I felt at that moment. And my second son followed in his footsteps, and I was out there every Friday crying. You know, anything worth doing is worth doing to excess, you know. And those two boys have grown up to be fine gentlemen. They're both very successful in their insurance businesses, and they've given me some beautiful grandchildren. And as a matter of fact, I want to tell you about my second son out in the San Fernando Valley. He and his wife have given me three grandsons. And a few years ago, they decided to change their religion, and they became born-again Christians. And I went out to the wedding. It's important that I tell you that, because the rest of my story kind of winds up in there. And I went out to the wedding, and we went to his home for the reception, because they have a beautiful home out there in Thousand Oaks. And those Christians were walking around sipping champagne, you know, sipping. And I was sitting next to a lady that was sipping champagne and putting it down and sipping it. I wanted to say, God damn it, drink it, you know. See, that's what makes me alcoholic right there. But, you know, they're just such wonderful kids. But, you know, I could go on for many more minutes telling you about the wonderful things that AA has provided me with. And I could take an hour doing that, and maybe even more. But I'm here also to share my pain, because, you see, my daughter at the age of 14 picked up her first drink, and another alcoholic was born. And I was to know the sleepless nights and the not knowing where she was or if she was, going to the police stations, assigning APBs, going to juvenile halls, all this. Until one day she came, and you see, I had a blind eye to all that. I thought she was just going through a phase. And one day she came to me and said she had reached a crisis in her life and wanted to change. And it was precisely at that time that God took me out of the hospital. And I was able to sell my home to the bank down on the corner who wanted it for a parking lot, and get the money that I needed to move to Honolulu. And that's where I moved to Honolulu. And I ran a recovery house for women at St. Francis Hospital there. And my daughter did well there for a couple of months. But again, she got caught up in her disease. And again, it was out and in. And I knew that I was killing her and she was killing me. And I joined Al-Anon. We started an Al-Anon meeting in that hospital. And they gave me the strength and direction that I needed to take her down to the Honolulu airport and do the last thing I ever wanted to do, and that was to put her on the plane and tell her to get the hell out of my life, because I was killing her and she was killing me, and I knew that. And so it was that a couple of months later, my supervisor gave me a week's vacation, and I wanted to go to San Francisco. No, I wanted to go to Southern California and visit my old home group because I needed to fill my cup with some of that industrial strength AA that they have there. And I walked into a Sunday night meeting, and my daughter was reading chapter 5 from the podium, and it tore me up. And I wish I could tell you that from that day to this, she's never had any other alcohol or drugs. But unfortunately, I have no such report to give you. Because the most painful part of my sobriety of my life happened a few years ago when I had to legally remove her 18-month-old son and take him into my home, knowing that I had to put him up for adoption, and it almost killed me. My sons, neither one could take him at that time. I was working. My mother was in and out of the hospital dying. And I was given a month leave of absence to resolve this problem. And I tell you, it was the worst month I ever put in my life. I just could not hear what the AA people were saying to me. Don't ask me what step I was working, because I was incapable of doing anything. I was so much in pain. I had a fleeting thought of suicide. That's how painful it was for me, because I could not give this kid up and never know what happened to him again. I could not put him in a foster home. I could not do that. But I'm here to tell you that God did for me what I could not do for myself. Because through my born-again Christian daughter-in-law, she had a born-again Christian couple up in Sacramento in the military who had been married for 10 years, a very good marriage, and they desperately wanted this little boy. And I thought to myself, at least there's a vague connection there. I had to unwillingly give him up, but they took this little boy, and that's all I wanted, to know that he was going to be in a loving, kind home. And I'm here to tell you that God always compensates, because that woman has written to me regularly, sent me pictures. And last year, the AA people of St. Louis asked me to come and speak at their banquet. And I almost came through the phone, because see, the adoptive father is a major out in Belleville. And I got to visit their house, and we had lunch, and I'm known as Aunt Mary to this kid. And we went down to the mall, and I bought him every goddamn thing he wanted. And God also compensated her, because she just had a little girl a couple of years ago, so he's got a little sister. As for my daughter, she can be found, if she's not in jail, which she is at the present time again, when she's out of jail, she's up some alley with a needle in her arm, or down on some dingy corner in Santa Ana, doing what she has to do to get what she has to get, and I don't have to be more specific. And so it is that I live a day at a time, a step at a time, and a prayer at a time. And I know that over the world, there are over 2 million recovered alcoholics that are praying for her and people like her. And you know, I'm a living example that it's possible to stay sober with a broken heart. Everything I have, everything I hold dear, I owe to those people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. But most of all, for teaching me to walk in the dignity of sobriety. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Mary, thank you very much. Every year, excuse me, every year at the end of the luncheon, some of us usually say to each other, well, we'll never be able to equal that next year, and we're going to be saying that this year, I'm sure. One more reminder that tapes will be available. The luncheon is now over. Thank you all for coming, and let's close with the Lord's Prayer.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,